Brian and I have arrived in sunny Melbourne. We're really excited about our trip to Australia. We've been planning this for some period of time, our virtual trip to Australia. And we're really lucky to be joined here today by a great friend and colleague, Ian Davis from Melbourne. Ian, do you want to introduce yourself? You were really kind to pick us up from the virtual airport, which is great because not all of our hosts have done that. But we're grateful. What we'd like to do is we'd like to kick off by introducing yourself, and then perhaps where you're going to take us for dinner, and if there's a bar or a theme that you might want to do before the big event tomorrow morning.
Yeah, thanks, Tom and Brian. Welcome to Melbourne. Great to have you here. I'm sorry that I had to pick you up on that unicycle, but that was all that was available. And I've got to say, you really are much better looking in real life than you are virtually. It's quite striking. So thank you. I'm Ian Davis. I'm a medical oncologist here in Melbourne, professor of medicine and head of the clinical school at Eastern Health in Eastern Melbourne and also at Monash University. And I'm also chair of ANZUP Cancer Trials Group. And we've been waiting for you to come to Melbourne for a long time. You can see how beautiful the weather is here in our what is now our winter, or cold summer, as the Northern Hemisphere people like to call it. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to take you for dinner, Tom, because your reputation precedes you. So basically,
you've been kicked out of most good places in Melbourne.
It's hard to get in, to be honest. Right. It's hard to get in.
I did find a kebab trailer, though, where your name is not on the do not serve list. So
I'd love a kebab. We haven't had kebabs. Brian, can we do kebabs in Australia?
It sounds great. Sounds awesome.
Ian, can I ask you a question? The first question I want to ask is that the ANZUP Group is seen as a really successful organization. You've nailed a couple of global trials. You've got New England Journal publications. You've changed practice. You've got into a common cancer. And you've managed to do it via a group, an investigator-initiated group. Extremely hard to do. What's the story of its success, and where is it going next?
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'd love to be able to say I understood how this has happened. I think I rely on the kindness and generosity of others, certainly. So ANZUP is the Australian and New Zealand Urogenital and Prostate Cancer Trials Group, and we are a multidisciplinary genitourinary cancer cooperative clinical trials group looking at prostate, kidney, bladder, testicular and penile cancer most recently. Been established since 2008. We've got just under 1,800 members across the globe. Pleased to say that Brian was one of our international speakers at our annual scientific meeting a few years ago, and we're still looking to get you down, Tom, once we can work out the whole visa thing.
I'm so up for it. And I apologised about what happened to the at passport control last time. I think it's been forgiven.
Still, it did make the front page of the paper, so that's always good. So ANZUP's been in existence since 2008 and brings together a whole group of researchers and clinicians and community representatives involved in the care of people with genitourinary cancers and research into this. And our reason for existence is pretty simple. We want to improve outcomes for people affected by these cancers. So as that has evolved over time, we've done a few small-scale trials in Australia and New Zealand, but more recently had the pleasure and privilege of being able to work with other groups internationally. Probably the trial that's had the highest profile most recently is the ENZAMET trial, which was presented at the plenary session at ASCO last year and simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So, Ian, before we go into ENZAMET, tell us a little bit about the key things you thought that made this group successful. So it's been 12 years, I guess, right, since 2008. And I'm sure you've grown and evolved over the years. Like, if you could point out the key things that allowed you to get to ENZAMET from your humble beginnings, I think that'd be helpful.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. So it was one of those situations where it seemed like a good idea at the time. We had in Australia one group looking at one genitourinary cancer in the form of the ANZ Germ Cell Trials Group that was led by Guy Toner. So that involved a range of disciplines, but only one type of cancer. We've got the Trans-Tasman Radiation Oncology Group, which looks at a range of different cancers, but only one modality, radiation therapy. And we didn't have any group that covered all disciplines and all types of gender urinary cancer. So we thought that might be a good idea. We initially set up a group through the Clinical Oncology Society of Australia, which is the ASCO equivalent in Australia. Mm-hmm. And there was an enormous interest in that. We wanted to set up a trials group at the time but didn't have the resources, but fortunately got some funding from initially Cancer Council Victoria and then subsequently from Cancer Australia that allowed us to bring the germ cell trials group together with another precursor group to form ANZAP. And it's really gone from strength to strength since then. I was pleasantly surprised at the level of interest, but amazingly surprised at just how generous people are in giving up their time and expertise to make this work. So the way the group is structured is that we've got four disease-specific subcommittees, prostate, kidney, germ cell, and what used to be bladder is now bladder, urothelial, and penile. And we've got two other subcommittees that cross those, quality of life and supportive care, and the translational committee. These are all underneath our scientific advisory committee, which is made up of a broad multidisciplinary group. And we have a consumer advisory panel that advises all levels of the organisation.
Ian, how do you make sure that all of the Australian groups take part, and what's in it for them, number one? And then the other piece is around the money. How do you make the money work? Because we've been in South America and other parts of the world have said one of the real challenges of doing investigator-initiated trials is talking people into supporting it from a financial perspective.
That's certainly the biggest challenge. The first part, getting people involved. People have voted with their feet. They've seen that this is something that was needed and that is working, and they want to come and contribute. So if you come to our annual scientific meeting, you'll see the energy and the collegiality, people from different disciplines engaging in conversation and thinking about where the needs are, what's the science on the horizon, how we can bring those things together. The funding is always challenging. We get some infrastructure funding from Cancer Australia. A lot of our work is supported by fundraising, and we are a charity in Australia and New Zealand. We're a not-for-profit company. But to support the specific clinical trials, that's always the most challenging part. We need to go out for competitive grants, which are very difficult. And more recently, we've had some successful studies where we've partnered with industry, where industry has supplied drug and the cost of doing the trial, but it's been sponsored by us or by our collaborative group through the University of Sydney. And we've controlled the study, shared the information with the industry partner, but we've kept control of the study.
Yeah. Ian, what percent of your money comes from industry and what percent comes from charity?
Most of our running costs of the organisation come from fundraising, a little bit from Cancer Australia. We've had a very successful initiative called the Below the Belt Pedalthon, where people, as the name suggests, it's a cycling event in Sydney.
I hope so.
Yes, that's right. And all of it.
We try and keep these as clean as possible, by the way.
And all of the cancers are below the belt, including kidney cancer, if you wear
your belt. Oh, I see. Yeah, it's an excellent point.
Especially where you put your belt. We're very proud to say that all of the funds we raise from those events go to support research activities, mainly aimed at supporting projects that otherwise would not be funded, but that we hope will lead on to future ANZAP trials. And we've had some good success out of that so far.
Right.
But in terms of the actual trials, the vast majority of those, particularly the larger ones, have been in partnership with industry, which we need to do carefully because we are funded by the federal government. And a few have been funded by competitive grants.
Yeah. So, I mean, similar to maybe the US cooperative group system, at least in part, but it's, as Tom said, a real role model for success for how to get this type of organization going that's had great success.
Because speaking frankly, before we get into it, I think in the US, it's easier to do cooperative group studies because I think inevitably the pharmaceutical industry wants to work much more actively in the US. And I think one of my global observations of our trip so far, other than the fact that you snore on aeroplanes, Brian, is the other observation would be that I get the impression that the ability of the country to attract money from the pharmaceutical industry to do investigator-initiated trials is almost a key driver for whether or not they're successful. Yeah. We were in Brazil recently, and they had lots of ideas, but the bottom line was they were saying it's very hard to get these off the ground. What you've done, Ian, is you've got yourself a footprint and a reputation, and people will keep coming back because of your success, and that needs to be admired, and you guys need to be congratulated for that.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? The success breeds success and more funding.
Brian, I interrupted your question about Enzimet.
I was just going to say, I was going to start to talk about Enzimet and sort of, if, Ian, if you just take us through the design, you know, maybe where the idea came from, major, and then the major findings, we could talk about that.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, so like all good ideas, this came up over some beers. I think it was probably at ASCO in 2011 or 2012. I was there with Chris Sweeney and there was a number of others, and we're trying to see where the gaps were in prostate cancer. And at that time, this was before CHAARTED, of course. So ADT was the standard of care for metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Enzalutamide and other AR-targeted therapies were coming on the scene and being used in CRPC. So it was an obvious question. Could we see an advantage in bringing these treatments earlier in the disease course in the hormone-sensitive setting? So this is a very, very simple design. We're taking men with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer at the beginning of treatment with testosterone suppression and asking the question of whether addition of enzalutamide or a standard antiandrogen to those men would improve overall survival. So it was ambitious. Particularly since there were life-prolonging therapies now in the castrate-resistant setting. But we thought that this was a question that needed to be answered. We got the go-ahead for this study on the 9th of August 2013 from Astellas, who was providing the drug. They said, this is great, we want to support it. Just one thing, you have to have the first patient on this study by the 31st of March. And I said, what year exactly? And they said, that gave us 7 months to go from a half-page concept to fully-fledged protocol, all the submission documents, local input, iterations of that, identification of sites, identification of international sites, because it was going to be an 1,100-patient study, input from them, getting coordination of what standard practice was, ethics submission, ethics resubmission, site activation and recruitment. And I'm pleased to say we got a patient on the study on the 31st of March. It was a matter of pride by then. We also did the same for the concurrent ENZA-RAD study, which is also still running. So that was an exciting time.
And Ian, just tell me about the top line, because we know kind of the results of the study, we know they've been published. But what I'd like to know is how it's, because people must feedback to you about how it's affected their practice and how patients are choosing between Enzimet and CHAARTED in terms of do you get chemotherapy first or do you get enzalutamide first? What's your approach to that in Australia right now?
The top-level outcomes, obviously, were that addition of enzalutamide reduced the hazard of death by 33%. And also, we allowed patients to receive docetaxel also concurrently at the beginning of treatment. This is in distinction from ARCHES, where the docetaxel had to be completed before the study treatment commenced. So we actually had some overlap of treatment there. And what we found, obviously, was enzalutamide gave a benefit. Addition of docetaxel did not give any extra benefit in terms of overall survival, although there were some hints of activity. We did see improvements in PSA, progression-free survival, and clinical progression-free survival. So we're waiting for longer follow-up to see if that translates into improved overall survival.
Now, Ian, just before you get there, Ian, so is there cross-resistance between immune therapy and chemotherapy and targeted and hormone therapy if you target them? Or are they synergistic, are they additive, or are they antagonistic?
I think these sorts of questions were the ones who are asked most frequently after the presentation. I believe, and I think we expected, that the triplet therapy, testosterone suppression, enzalutamide and docetaxel, would give us an even greater effect. And we haven't seen that at this first interim analysis, what was the planned interim analysis for overall survival. We may see it later on down the track. So it's an interesting question. Part of docetaxel's activity is mediated through androgen receptor biology. And it's very clear that docetaxel works differently in cancers that have not undergone selection pressure for signaling through the androgen receptor. The activity in the hormone-sensitive setting, as we've seen in CHAARTED and STAMPEDE, is qualitatively and quantitatively much higher than it is in the castrate-resistant setting. So there's something fundamentally different about these sorts of cancers.
So how do you choose, Ian? Then what's your algorithm? Because I've heard Chris talk about this many times and make a pretty cogent argument for chemo first. But obviously, I think the global practice, I think, is to not use chemo up front, is to use ENZA or another agent. What's your approach?
Well, the approach in Australia is very easy. The only agent we have approved is docetaxel.
Okay.
So if you had the choice, Ian, how would you – let's pretend you could do what you wanted. What do you think would be optimal for your patients in the knowledge that you could give any drugs you wanted?
Second most common question that we got asked. And I think the answer to this is there's no right answer, but there's no wrong answer either. So we know that there is benefit from testosterone suppression alone, and that's a good choice for some patients. Benefits by adding in docetaxel or enzalutamide or apalutamide. So any of those, if they're available, are reasonable options. And the things that will make you choose one or the other really will depend on the specific circumstances of this patient. So if you have someone who is very frail, testosterone suppression is the best option. If you have some cognitive impairment, then enzalutamide might not be the best option. The other thing to bear in mind is that the oral therapies go for several years until progression, whereas docetaxel is really over within six cycles and it's very cheap. So those are considerations for some patients.
I think we've doubled the number of Australians on this podcast right now.
Yeah, Ian, I've got a special guest I brought along for this leg of the trip. We left him at the airport initially, but he's made his own way to the hospital. Chris, welcome, Chris Sweeney. Chris, we're talking about your studies, and we're talking about Enzamet, and we're talking with Ian a bit about the ANZAP group and all the success that's been going on. And what I wanted, we were just coming towards the end, but Chris, what we just asked Ian, and I'm interested in your opinion, is about this question that we've talked about before, is can you give the triplet therapy? Can you give androgen-targeted therapy, enzalutamide, and chemotherapy concurrently? Should you sequence them? And if you're going to sequence them, what's the right order?
I came on just as Ian was finishing, and I agree 100%. My mantra is ask the patient what they want when presenting the different options. The other thing is, the first thing you need to ask, though, are they fit for chemotherapy? And if not, the hormones are the best options. If they are fit for chemotherapy and they have a high burden of disease, think about getting the docetaxel out of the way, having a hormone-only testosterone suppression, and then when the PSA goes up, immediately act on that and add the enzalutamide or abiraterone or apalutamide. Actually, can't do apalutamide because it's not approved for castration-resistant, ENZA or ABI. I mean, the bottom line is a person does best if they get both therapies in at some stage. At this stage, I think we see more toxicity than benefit with giving the triplet. But as Ian probably alluded to, hopefully within about 12, 18 months, we'll have data sets.
So, Chris, if you have a young, fit patient with lowish volume disease, then what would you give that patient? So fit for chemo, but low volume, you know, and the patient says, I'll do whatever you say, doc.
So low volume comes in two varieties. One is the metachronous low volume, and that's the patient who has a rising PSA. You scan them, the PSA is 15 and they have two bony metastases. And you can think about maybe some stereotactic radiation and the hormones with it. The role of the stereotactic radiation, unclear, and I'll come back to that. But we, just with testosterone suppression alone, we know these patients have a median survival of 8 years. And we see in both CHARTED and GTUG, these metachronous low volume have no evidence of a benefit with docetaxel. It may delay prolong their PSA progression-free survival, but not their overall survival in those two subgroups. So I'm very...
What happened?
I don't know. It might have been my phone crashed with four people.
I don't know. Chris was talking, and he was talking about Abby, and then he... Hey, Ian.
Ian, sorry. I might have been Chris joining, but somehow it crashed. It doesn't normally do that.
No, sorry. I just had to leave for a moment. The federal police came to the door looking for you.
Hey, what'd you do to me?
No, I don't know, Chris. I don't know what. Listen, we're going to just keep going. The show must go on. It's never happened before.
Was it me or you? I'll take.
No, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't You didn't touch a thing, Chris. You were doing fine. I think it's my. I think it's me. Okay. Anyway, Ian.
Big button.
Ian, I'll stop touching the button this time. Chris. Brian had just asked you a question. Brian, could you ask it again?
You know, I think we got Chris's response. He was talking about chemo versus a hormone-based approach up front in that healthy, low-volume, I think non-oligometastatic patient. Chris mentioned SBRT, but I'm not thinking about that phenotype. You could just sort of continue on that front, yeah.
For sure. So the other person is, if they have extensive nodal disease, and we know they, even though they have a lot of spots on the scan, but node only, they actually also have a much longer prognosis than someone who has 5 burning metastases. We know that from multiple data sets. So even then, I would still consider the hormonal therapy approach. Where it gets a little bit more mixed results is in the de novo low volume. So they're patients who present with a PSA of 20 on screening. You do their CAT scan and the bone scan, and you see that they have a few bony metastases. That's it. And the GTOP 15, the French study, and the charted subgroup of low volume, both those studies didn't see a benefit. Charted did that as a prospective subgroup, but not see a benefit. We saw a hazard ratio of 0.86 and maybe something happens and there's a benefit for some patients in that group. But there is a consistent signal with abiraterone, enzalutamide, and apalutamide across all the studies in that group, whereas it's less consistent because the Stampede, docetaxel, all de novo low volume, they saw a hazard ratio of 0.76. It crossed 1.0, but the point estimate looked better. 25% of those patients were missing for the biomarker image analysis, so it's retrospective. So there is some uncertainty because of that. So I say the results are mixed. I see with the docetaxel, I see that results are more consistent with the hormones. But if you go with the hormones in these low-volume de novo metastatic, don't forget about docetaxel for castration-resistant. It's not one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's when.
Yeah. It sounds like you use both in your clinical
maximizing
practice.
Maximizing the benefit as well. Yeah. Making sure that everyone gets the maximum benefit.
So,
whole low volume question might go out the window when we start using other imaging modalities like PSMA PET.
Well, Ian, I'm going to pick you up on that. A lot of these low volume patients have more disease on PSMA PET, but we still see that they didn't have that much of a benefit. So we actually would have to do a study of low volume by conventional scan and see what is their benefit with docetaxel polymetastatic by PSMA PET versus not polymetastatic low volume by conventional scan. Most patients who have low volume disease probably have multiple lesions on PSMA PET.
Right.
So I disagree with that PSMA PET is going to change our thinking about this low volume group.
Oh, Chris, Ian took us out for dinner last night. We're trying to be nice to him here.
I'm not. I was out to dinner with him actually last night on a teleconference call. So I know you're actually telling a fib there, Tom.
So Tom, maybe we can wrap up by saying, what's the next wave of trials then in frontline metastatic? What's ongoing or what's ANZUP going to do? Where are we going from here?
So there are two questions there. Let's start with what's the frontline prostate cancer space doing right now? And then Ian, if you could answer the question, the ANZUP question second to that and how you're contributing to that.
I'll go with the first one and say, we just need the long-term follow-up of the triplet versus the doublets. And as you know, we take a lot of learnings from the castration resistant to see what to take forward to the hormone sensitive. And that's a work in progress. There's talk about CDK4/6 inhibitors, AKT inhibitors, but I think we need more mature data on the CRPC before we launch into that. But I think the two forays are biomarker work to see if we can find out who actually may benefit from looking at a TRuST biopsy gene expression profile, who benefits from the hormones versus the docetaxel. There's a big effort between Stampede, Enzamet, and Charted that's starting to sort that out. So I think triplet versus doublet and the biomarkers of the TRUST biopsies are the more near-term forays that we'll be able to report on.
Great.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think the real challenge here is that we're increasingly recognising that not all prostate cancer is the same, and it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. We're seeing different flavours, different molecular subtypes, different clinical phenotypes coming through. So selection of treatment and sequencing of treatment, particularly in patients who have short-lived responses to treatment, are going to be the next big challenge. The other area that ANZAP has just dived into, though, together with the global consortium that we're able to bring together through Enzimet, is the DAZZLE HICAP study, which is being led by Chris. This is looking at men with localized, very high-risk prostate cancer who will be receiving radiation therapy and testosterone suppression. And the question is whether addition of darolutamide or compared to standard of care will improve outcomes there. And it's an interesting study in a couple of respects. It's a novel agent, obviously, but there's two main subgroups of patients here, those with localized disease having radiation therapy as the primary modality, and those with persisting PSA after prostatectomy planned for radiation therapy. And what they have in common is a similar high risk of developing metastases. So the primary endpoint here is going to be metastasis-free survival based on the ICECAP data. And we've been able to bring together the groups that worked with us on Enzimet. So that includes Cancer Trials Ireland, Canadian Cancer Trials Group, groups in the USA now through the PCCTC, Prostate Cancer Clinical Trials Consortium. And this has been a very successful initiative. And we're looking forward to seeing that go ahead. I'm delighted to say that we are able to open that study and enroll our first patients, even during COVID. I think that's a real testament to everybody's commitment.
Ian, Chris, before we stop in prostate cancer, what's your most exciting biomarker and what's your most exciting new drug? Is there a new field in prostate cancer that we haven't gone into yet beyond chemotherapy and hormone-derived therapy, which is going to be a new dawn? So, but new biomarkers, new drug, name one of each. Have you got one for me, Chris?
I would say I'm most excited about the potential for the Decipher platform of multi-gene expression profiles to help classify those who benefit from hormones versus docetaxel.
So gene expression profiling at baseline to distinguish between which patients. So you're going for a biomarker approach there.
Yep, for that would be predictive for who should get the hormone versus the docetaxel.
Yeah, okay, I'll buy that.
And the most exciting therapy would be the lutetium PSMA work. Mm. And that's a whole other conversation. Yep. But I'm going to throw out a little bit of a caution.
Yeah.
As we know, some of these patients now live a long, long time, and we're giving a degree of radiation to these patients. So the risk-benefit on some potential bone marrow toxicity, long-term MDS, maybe have to be considered in when we're using it earlier. I'll just throw that out, but see what Ian says to that.
Ian, for you, a biomarker and a drug.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that. I don't know what the biomarker is yet, but we're hoping that the translational work from Enzimet might even throw up some candidates that will allow us to determine who might best respond to docetaxel and who might best respond to a drug like enzalutamide. And I think that would be very exciting. And I also agree with Chris. Lutetium PSMA is a very interesting approach. We had the therapy ANZAP study presented by Michael Hoffman orally at ASCO this year, which was a randomized phase 2 study in men thought suitable for cabazitaxel up against the active comparator of cabazitaxel. And we saw a significant improvement in PSA response rate, reduction of 50% or more in patients receiving lutetium PSMA. So it's really a matter of working out where that's going to fit in now into the treatment sequence, and a number of studies using that earlier in the disease course are now underway or in planning.
And do you have any concern
about... I'll throw in one other thing too, Tom, if I can.
Yeah, of course.
I'd love to know why immunotherapy has not been as successful as it should have been in prostate cancer. There's no reason why it shouldn't work. I just don't think we're using it properly yet, and I'd love to know what we need to do to make it work.
Well, sipulucel tea works for some people, we think.
Yeah. I mean, Ian, it's a discussion for a different day.
We'd love to come back.
But we'd love to come back. I've got lots of thoughts on it. I'm quite nervous about that whole field. I think that we're going to have to use, I think we're going to have to look beyond single agent immune checkpoint inhibition in combination with other drugs. I think there is scope there. And I'm not convinced, you know, I still feel that CTLA-4 in combination with other drugs may be active. And I'd like to, and I think we've got trials that may explore that. But I think unselected patients is not going to work. And because there are too many prostate cancer patients that have immune deserts, and I think they're very hard.
Tom, we got to catch a flight to Japan. We're in Japan.
We're going to Japan. We're going to Japan. This does sound exciting. Ian, direct flights from Melbourne to Japan, or do we have to change somewhere? If we could change in Honolulu, that would be great, because we did it last time, but it was, I've got to tell you, it was fantastic.
That's a little bit out of your way. It's a 10-hour flight due up on the map. So same time.
Okay.
But Tom, if you could put on some trousers, it'll help you get through immigration.
I've apologized. I've said I've apologized.
You also might want to realize is that there's one flight per day out of Australia to anywhere in the world right now.
Is that right?
We're going to Niigata.
So you're going to be going through San Francisco, I think. I think there's only one international flight via San Francisco anywhere.
And it's all up from here.
Ian, thank you very much indeed, Ian. Yep, as always, terrific. And good luck with the future. It sounds like you've done incredible work, and we continue to look to your group as a really successful beacon of investigator-initiated trials. So thank you for joining us today, and see you soon.